A visit to Silicon Valley's Moonshot Factory, or maybe Climate Shot in this case. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech, demystifying the digital economy. I'm Molly Wood. For our climate tech series, How We Survive, we're in Silicon Valley all week. And climate change is a giant problem, so we went to the company that thrives on tackling giant problems. X, formerly Google X, is the division of Alphabet devoted to moonshots, big, crazy technology bets that hopefully turn into companies. Its climate-related graduates include Dandelion, which harnesses heat from geothermal energy, and Malta, which uses salt to store excess energy produced from solar and wind farms. Astro Teller leads X. His official title is Captain of Moonshots. And a little trivia here, he goes everywhere at work on rollerblades.
Hi.
Hi. I'm Molly.
Hi, Molly. Astro.
Lovely to meet you.
I'm not standing. I guess this is mine.
Also, I'm reevaluating every entrance I've ever made. Well, awesome. I was saying that it's such a efficient way to solve that problem because you don't need anything external, like it's connected to you.
You have to clomp up the stairs. It takes a little bit of practice to clomp up the stairs. Otherwise, it's fine.
You just need to make them retract.
Or just get used to clomping.
Okay, so why rollerblades? Well, the X office is in a former mall. It is huge, and Teller decided it would be more efficient to roll places instead of walking. And this is actually how he thinks about most things, with this filter that is ruthlessly efficient, but still creative. So I asked him how much of X is focused on climate.
We certainly don't limit ourselves to the climate crisis, but there's no problem in the world that is metaphorically and literally burning as bright today. So roughly half of the things that are here and are brewing are connected in one way or another to the climate crisis, either trying to mitigate it or trying to adapt.
It sounds like, though, for X to take on a project, maybe even just that this has been a turn in recent years, there also has to be this glimmer of hope that there will be a market, that there has to be a business argument for taking on the project in the first place or hopefully graduating it. Is that fair to say? You're making a skeptical face.
I think de facto that's true, but that's not how we talk about it here. The way we talk about it is exactly the way I just described it to you.
Yep.
Huge problem in the world, radical proposed solution, breakthrough technology that might at least make that possible. Nowhere in there did I say make lots of money. There's a presumption that's sort of wired into the DNA at X, and really to all of Alphabet, though X may be a particular distillation of this attitude, that if you really solve a huge problem for the world, the money is going to come back and find us in some fair and elegant way, possibly not immediately. It's hard to predict exactly what the margins will be. But if you tell me you're going to solve a $10 trillion problem, I'm not going to be worried about whether or not we're going to get paid for it. Like, or if you are claiming that we're not going to get paid, I question whether we're really solving a problem for humanity.
So tell me about some of the things that you are working on, have graduated.
So food production, the making of food, the moving of food, the serving of food, that is about 30% of global greenhouse gas emissions. It's the single biggest thing. Roughly a third of food is lost or wasted. So there's enormous inefficiencies in this system. It is also the case that the world is starting to change faster and faster because of the climate crisis. And the tools that farmers have for understanding their crops, when all of those things are changing rapidly, it is not realistic to think that somehow the farmers of the world are going to cope elegantly with this rapid change. What if there was a way to understand, not at a per acre level, but literally at a individual plant level? How's that plant doing? How is it doing relative to last week? How is that plant doing in the specific conditions it's in relative to plants on the other side of the world? So you can start to understand things about where stuff should be planted and when it should be planted and when it should be harvested. And if you could manage plants on a per plant basis and instead of on a per 100 acre basis, mm-hmm. how much less pesticide could you use? So we have prototype buggies, which move through the fields, understand these crops, and help farmers and breeders to learn about their fields in a kind of resolution they've never had before, take care of their fields, and even change what their fields are going to be in future years, what crops they have. Having a sort of agricultural brain, I think that is very much in the adaptation part of the space. Yeah.
And you have the seawater project, right? That turns seawater into energy, and then you released essentially the schematics, right? How to do that so that maybe somebody else could?
Right. So what happened there was we said, look, there are 4 billion internal combustion engines in the world that are already in existence. Someone's already paid for them. It would be nice to fantasize they're just going to go away tomorrow, but they're not going to because it's a sunk cost. So people are going to put hydrocarbons of one kind or another into those gas tanks and burn them. That ship has sailed. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of borderline save the world. If we could make hydrocarbons, put them in the gas tank, they burn, they put CO2 in the air. If we could do that in a CO2 negative way for the first part of the cycle, then the whole cycle would be carbon neutral. Mm-hmm. That maybe is like save the world territory. So we built a box that literally takes seawater, pulls CO2 out of the seawater, takes some of the water, rips the oxygen and hydrogen apart, takes the hydrogen and the CO2 and mushes it together into hydrocarbons, into mm-hmm. methanol that you could burn in these gas tanks. The whole thing worked. And the reason that that's carbon negative, if you put energy in from solar or wind or something like that, and you're pulling CO2 out of the seawater and the oxygen or the CO2 in the atmosphere and the CO2 that's in solution in water have to stay in equilibrium. So when you pull it out of the seawater, it just gets sucked back into the seawater from the atmosphere. We felt so good. We were so ridiculously proud of what we had done. But we couldn't get line of sight, even being kind of optimistic, for this to be cheaper than about $15 gallon of gas equivalent. Mm-hmm. You have to burn somewhat different amount of methanol and gas. But when you look at a gallon of gas equivalent, it was going to be about $15. And that's in 8 or 9 years, and that's being somewhat optimistic.
Right.
That's not save the world territory. That's like a niche. Maybe some people feel good about it, but we just don't want to make people feel good. We want to actually save the world. And so we stopped it. But this was an example where we said, we desperately wanted this to work, but we're going to be dispassionate. We're going to be honest with ourselves that this wasn't it. Let's stop doing it and move on and spend our energy in a way that might save the world, that might really address the climate crisis. And we think we couldn't find any way through these problems that we ran into, but maybe somebody else can. So that's an example where we published the business results in Fast Company. Here's what we tried and here's why it didn't work. We published the science side of what we did in the International Journal of Greenhouse Gas Control. And so by putting those out there, we said, look, we're just giving this to the world. If anyone can figure out a way past the problems that we couldn't figure out, by all means, go do it.
So I'd love to get your thoughts then on the tech industry at large, because they've frankly been hesitant to invest in a big way in something that clearly has a market and an existential imperative. And I wonder what you think the responsibility is there, or if you think the solutions will come from outside the valley.
I certainly hope many solutions come from outside the valley. But look, my thing, it's probably going to lose money. It looks kind of shaky, but it's so good for the world. I just don't believe that. And it's not because I don't care. My version of caring is just a very hard-nosed, practical caring. I care so much to solve the problem that I'm willing to be dispassionate now in the name of getting these problems solved over 10 or 20 years. So the Silicon Valley may not have a time horizon which is conducive to solving certain kinds of problems. I don't know what to say except good luck to them, and we believe in longer time horizons.
And then talk to me about, and I've heard you talk about this before, but that equity is a huge part of this conversation. There's an environmental justice aspect to a lot of this work, and the idea that commercial solutions, if they appear, may not be affordable to everyone, may not be available. How much do you think of that day to day? How much of that is that part of your conversations?
I think about it all the time, but I'm very torn about it. This is a perfect example about short-term sympathy actually being the enemy of long-term sympathy. The reality is most innovation at the beginning It doesn't work super well, and it ends up being very expensive. So your early customers need to be price insensitive. Mm-hmm. And by and large, there are two price insensitive customer groups, wealthy people and the military. If your plan is to make something that's going to be awesome in Africa, that's great. But you need to tell me a story about what the beachhead is where we get paid enough in the early days to get the right traction so that it survives to the point where it can change the lives of a billion people. I'm okay with that in the name of getting as quickly as possible to a widespread solution.
But then why couldn't that apply to the seawater fuel? I would have paid the $15. I mean, okay, maybe not me.
Exactly.
But definitely some of my neighbors.
The moment where you said, not me.
I'm a journalist, which, man.
I know.
Public radio.
High five. I love public radio. But when we went and tested the hypothesis, almost nobody was really going to do it. There were certain things like jet fuel that maybe could work out. There are a few people who have started these niches. So we didn't believe, again, not that it couldn't work, but if we can give this information to the world, let someone who wants to drive that to do it. And we felt that the kinds of system integration and scaling that we are really good at could better be put towards something which is not going to have such a narrow and complicated and marketing-oriented path, because that was going to turn out to have this very heavy component of trying to convince people mm-hmm. to do something which my interest in purpose and my interest in profit, I don't see as in conflict. I actually see them as in synergy, because finding something that's really solving a problem for the world and that makes money is going to cause it to get bigger over time. And that's actually what's going to cause it to solve the problem for the world.
Right. Astro Teller leads X, the moonshot division of Alphabet. And now for some related audio, which is a little bit more geeking out about this precision agriculture buggy that Teller mentioned. Agriculture is an area where climate innovation can potentially have a major impact. Last month, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change put out the results of a research study specifically around climate and land use. And it said, among other things, that sustainable farming and better soil management could have huge impacts on carbon emissions and improving food security as the climate changes. So we asked Astro Teller to show us more of this ag tech they're working on. We wandered through X with Astro on his rollerblades, clomping up and down the stairs, past the custom 3D printing lab where they print the parts they need for doohickeys that don't exist yet, down a hall, past the kitchen, turning out food for the cafeteria, which smelled really good, into basically a garage at the back of the building with these big racks of tools and electronics. And there, we found these two big, blue, slightly spider-like vehicles that I asked Teller to describe.
This is like a cute golf cart-sized thing on kind of stilty legs with wheels at the bottom. And
you like rolling some big golf carts. This is pretty big.
All right. It's smaller than a car, but I'll take that. The design criteria were for this sort of learning prototype was we want to be able to put lots of sensors on it so we can learn lots of things. This is not a finished product, but we don't want to have to make lots of different ones of these. So you want to be able to change the wheelbase for very narrow rows or very wide rows. You also want to be able to get the tummy of the learning platform very close to the ground if it's something like strawberries or melons, but might also want to get it very high off the ground, extend its legs if you're going over something very high like wheat or grapes. And so this was designed to have these different shapes that it could get into, that could roll over them and learn a lot about each plant. And there are some specific goals of the way we're learning that are like know exactly where you are, not within a meter or two. You want to be able to pass that strawberry plant today and think, oh, that's Bob number 975. And then a week later, you want to recognize the same strawberry plant, be like, hey, Bob, and pay attention to how Bob 975 has changed over the last week. If this thing were to go down the field super slowly, that's not very interesting, because we want to create 1,000x kind of leverage for farmers and breeders. But if this thing is going really fast, that makes it harder to look at all the nuances of what it's doing. It has to be very safe in the field. It can't hurt the plants. It can't hurt the farmers. So this sort of blue buggy is designed to try to solve all of those things.
Like go the right speed, take photos. Does it sense other things like the, I don't know, like heat or...
Yes, it has an enormous...
Bob has a hotspot.
It has an enormous number of sensors. I am confident in telling you, I couldn't tell you every sensor that's on there. A, because I don't know, and B, I bet you they've added at least one sensor since the last time I talked to them, because this is not a product. This is a learning platform, and so they're constantly taking off sensors. No, that one's too expensive. Putting on another one. Hey, could we see something interesting with this, etc.
And is this where a partnership would come in? Like, would you go to a commercial ag operator and say, "Can we test this? Is it being tested now?"
So we're working with, household name, large ag companies in North America, and saying, we want to be able to help small farmers and really big farmers help us learn in fields, like real working fields. And we want to be able to help both with the sort of standard, what most people would think of as food production process, but also with the breeding process of creating new versions of what we eat faster, because that's part of the adaptation problem.
You can find a link to that latest IPCC report and some of its findings about agriculture at marketplacetech.org, and visit our site for pictures of the buggy. Also on our website, you'll find the director's cut of my interview with Astro Teller called The Source Code. We actually talked for almost an hour about tech and moonshots and projects they killed and the tension between creating tech miracles and making the economics of those miracles work outright. Tomorrow, what other big tech companies are doing and the cities who are ready to buy what they're cooking up. I'm Molly Wood, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM. You count on Marketplace Tech to help you understand the intersection between technology and the economy and all the ways it affects our lives. As a nonprofit news organization, we count on listeners like you to support this kind of journalism. Think of it as an investment in your lifelong education. Any donation helps, and if you give today, you'll help unlock a $50,000 challenge from the Candida Fund. Become a Marketplace investor at marketplace.org, and thanks.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.